love that Hammond B3 organ. That was a tune called The Gift, composed and performed by Wayne Horvitz and his band Zony Mash. Welcome to Relevant Tones. My name is Stephen Anthony Rawson, and whether you're new to the show or a longtime listener, thanks so much for tuning in. Our guest on today's episode is composer and keyboardist Wayne Horvitz. Wayne is the leader and principal composer for a number of groups, including the Snow Ghost Trio, Sweeter Than the Day, the Gravitas Quartet, and the Royal Room Collective Music Ensemble. He's also written for groups like the Kronos Quartet, the Seattle Symphony, and Music for Film, and he owns and operates the club The Royal Room in Seattle's Columbia City. Wayne and I got to speak last week at his Seattle home about a number of music projects he's worked on over the years, as well as his musical style and people and collaborators who've been with him along the way. But before we dive in, I want to let you know that you can support Relevant Tones by becoming a subscriber on Patreon. For just $5 a month, you can help us continue to bring you interviews and music by some of the world's most creative musicians. Please consider giving us your support at patreon.com/relevanttones. And with that, let's hear my conversation with composer Wayne Horvitz.
I wasn't looking to go to music school. I really was a very, very late starter. I had played in some blues bands, and I had played, you know, sort of self-taught. I wasn't particularly serious about music. I was really very, very involved in as a fan. I mean, I listened to music constantly. And of course, sort of everybody does in high school, but I really listened a lot. I was listening to new things. I was listening to Electric Miles Davis. I was listening to Cecil Taylor. I was checking out stuff like that last year when I was living at home with my folks. And a little bit before that, the year before in 11th grade, I'd actually lived on the West Coast. I left my parents' house, lived with my brother for a while, and then with some friends. And so I was kind of in a weird place, but it was Berkeley in the early 70s, and there was so much music going on. So I went from sort of the Grateful Dead to John Coltrane pretty quickly, you know. And I listened to, there was a Harold Saunders record that I found for a dollar in one of those famous, you know, used bookstores and record stores on the Ave that really changed my life. It had that track Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt on it. And that track continues to be sort of part of my life in weird ways. I mean, Honey Chirac played on that, and I got to know Sonny later, and I heard him playing that tune in his own band. My band Zony Mash later played that tune, the Upper Egypt part of it. And yeah, there was a funny connection with that track. He starts out almost sounding like a rock and roll saxophonist, like Junior Walker or something, and then goes to this thing. So I related to it in a way that I didn't relate to Hank Mobley or Charlie Parker. I mean, later I came to relate to that music very strongly, but I didn't so much then because I wasn't a jazz kid. I mean that seriously. I mean, I came to meet all these people, including all the kids who were going to Berkeley High when I was there, who I later met in New York, or the kids who went there a little later than when I was there. But I wasn't connected to that at all because those people could already really play. I mean, Steve Bernstein and Peter Applebaum and Charlie Hunter and people like that who were at Berkeley, or all the, just like the high schools here in Seattle. I mean, these are, you know, 15, 14, 15, 16-year-olds who already have a pretty serious command of their instrument, and I did not, you know. So I moved to Santa Cruz to go to college thinking I would major in something. You don't have to declare a major right away. I was taking classes in Spanish literature and in anthropology, and I actually got to study with Gregory Bateson, who was a really interesting philosopher that I thought was amazing. And in the meantime, for some reason, I decided to get serious about music, but I couldn't get serious about music in the school because I wasn't good enough. I mean, I couldn't get into any of the regular music classes. I was a beginner, and from their perspective. But my freshman year of college, without any music classes, I practiced 8 hours a day. I practiced from 8 to noon and then from 8 to midnight, Monday through Friday. And on the weekends, I only practiced Saturday morning and Sunday evening so I could party Saturday night and sleep it off Sunday morning. And, you know, I mean, I was, you know, 21 and at Santa Cruz in the 70s. You had to do a little bit of that. So I quickly met a huge community of people who were really into kind of the music I was into, which was, yes, we were listening to Cecil Taylor and Ornette, but we were also listening to Weather Report a lot. and still Electric Miles Davis. And I met some friends, and I had a Fender Rhodes, and we put together a band that was sort of, you know, trying to be in that zone. And I started, you know, I did take some lessons. I took some music classes, the ones that were available to me, because a lot of them weren't. But there was a jazz class. There were some ethnomusicology classes. The other interesting thing is that, do you know who Gordon Mumma is? He was the technical director for John Cage. Yeah. So Gordon arrived at Santa Cruz, obviously in the sort of classical music department, literally the same time I did. And he organized a lot of interesting concerts that I started going to. So very early on, I was seen, like I remember within days of going there. And again, you know, I was thinking about Otis Spann and the Jefferson Airplane as much as I was thinking about anything else. And I went and saw this concert with two pianists and two guys sitting at tables with a bunch of gear who were processing the pianos. But it was very much presented as a classical concert. It was a new music concert. It wasn't an improvised music concert. And one of the pianists was Chris Brown, who later became a really good friend of mine and taught at Mills for many years. And one of the persons doing electronics was this guy named Carl Fravel, who went on to do a whole bunch of stuff. And I think Larry Polansky may have been involved, who went on to teach at Dartmouth and was much more in the new music community. And then Gordon brought James Tenney, and I heard James Tenney do the Concord Sonata. None of this was in my, you know, comfort zone or, you know, at all, but I was intrigued by it. And I really think Gordon had a lot to do with me feeling kind of okay with this gray area between, you know, at the same time I did start learning about chord changes, playing jazz, all that kind of stuff. So I met a lot of like-minded people. My wife Robin Holcomb was there. I met there Mark Miller, who's later known as with the initials M.E. on John Zorn's records. My friend Dave Sulson, who's still in New York City. Carolyn Romberg, this woman who unfortunately has passed. And then a whole bunch of other people, including dancers and painters and people like that, who we all sort of in the course of a year or two moved to New York. My friend Polly Bradfield, who no one knows where she is anymore. I mean, literally, John Zorn, myself, and a bunch of other people have tried to find her, and she's just disappeared. She was a good friend in college, and she moved to New York first, and she called me up one day and said, I met this guy named Eugene Chadbourne and this guy named John Zorn, and they're doing a duo thing, and they've got a gig in San Francisco and something in LA. Can you do something for them in Santa Cruz? So John and Eugene came to basically a friend's house and did what we now call a house concert. We just didn't even call it that then. And, you know, they got off the bus and we picked them up and we fed them dinner and they played a duo concert. And the next morning we took them back to the bus station. But that's how I first met John. And I moved to New York shortly after that.
Studio Henry, and I'd love to hear you talk a bit about that and how you got performances going. And I know how you lived is part of that.
Yeah, well, it was inexpensive to live there. We moved into a place that we were going to make into a loft, and it was a total ripoff. So before we knew it, we were in the same building that actually Zorn still lives in, and that Polly lived in, and that my friend Dave Soulson lived in, and on and on and on. And it was on 7th Street. The rent was incredibly cheap. And Studio Henry started because we needed a rehearsal space, and we found this basement in the West Village that literally the floors were dirt. I mean, there was no floor in there, and it was just filled with old radios and televisions. And on the top of the stairs, it said, you know, radios, TVs, electronics repaired, call Henry. And the guy had, I think, used this as a workspace for years, and he just abandoned it. And these people rented it to us for $125 a month. And what's mind-blowing is we split the rent five ways, and there were months when some of us couldn't make the rent. You know, I mean, he couldn't come up with the $25. But I had a friend, Paul Chilkoff, who was a friend in Santa Cruz, who was a saxophone player, and a few other friends who had sort of minor carpentry, or in his case, pretty good carpentry skills. He built just a wood floor over the dirt. I mean, it wasn't a proper foundation. We just did it. And we somehow got a baby grand piano down there. And there was no intention to make it a performance space. And I'm not sure what happened. We might have had a party once or twice or something. There was a discount beer place where we could get cases of beer and we'd sell them for a dollar a piece. And before you know it, I mean, I think Zorn did a game piece down there, and maybe we did our own band down there or something more as a party. And then we started to charge like, you know, a dollar to get in. And basically within 3 years, I mean, there were so many people standing on the street, particularly in the summer when it was hot and people would go outside during sets, that then, you know, the landlord said, "You guys, we don't really mind you doing this, even though it's not legal, but now it's too big. You know, you got to get out of here." I mean, that's the short version of the story. It was a little more complicated than that, but we didn't have a bathroom down there at first. I have a poster that's a benefit for putting in a bathroom, because there was the plumbing to do it. Yeah, to just have a toilet down there. And the poster says, "We will all benefit," which was an understatement. And so, but that place, you know, I wish there was more archival stuff from there. There's a lot of cassettes from there, thanks to a friend, Bruce Levinson, who actually, you and I were talking before the mic was turned on about the experimental sound studio in Chicago. Bruce gave him all their cassettes to archive. So he has tons of gigs from there that are there. And so, but you know, I mean, the Golden Palominos rehearsed down there. Laszlo did things there like with that were sort of like his band material, or Zorn did game pieces, David Moss. And then a lot, of course, besides all the gigs, it was a place that so many things were rehearsed.
It seems like groups were playing all the time. And just to connect this back to you hearing Gordon Mumma play and being really fascinated by that, how do you feel like your musical style was fitting in or absorbing the music around you? What do you feel, looking back, was your takeaway?
Yeah, and it's interesting because a lot of times, someone just asked me this the other day, you know, do you feel like moving to Seattle affected your music? And I feel like I really did make a big transition at one point, but it was before I moved to Seattle, unquestionably. I mean, there was these sort of obvious influences. I mean, I had loved the music of my youth. You know, I'd loved the Rolling Stones. I'd loved the band. I'd loved Bob Dylan. You know, I loved, and also I grew up in D.C., so particularly at parties, I mean, I was listening, you know, it wasn't just Sly Stone. It was the Isley Brothers. Yeah. It was, you know, all that kind of music and all the Motown music of the time. And when I really got so invested in wanting to play like Cecil Taylor, I kind of, you know, hit a wall with that, but not just technically, though I'm sure that's true too, but also, you know, aesthetically and also expressively. I mean, I think the whole high energy thing stopped serving me, even though I really admired it. And there were kind of two big things. First place, the art ensemble was just sneaking up on me in every possible way, you know. And for all of Roscoe Mitchell's abstraction, there's also those beautiful, sweet little tunes that are sometimes on records that are almost like, you know, children's songs or folk songs. They're just beautiful. And the fact that he kind of had that going on simultaneously, and the fact that their pieces felt more like, they felt more narrative to me. They felt more like they told a story, and they also felt, I was really attracted to the space. And I was listening to people like Paul Bley, who I really loved the space in his playing. And then I went and saw The Last Waltz, which was really funny because I had loved the band. And then I'd lived in Santa Cruz for 4 years. And the band came religiously for 4 years to Santa Cruz and always played downtown at the Civic Center. And they were in there, maybe not the heyday of their record making, which was the very first couple of years, but they were definitely in the heyday of their performing, you know, because I've heard tapes from then. And of course, I was just all about going up to the Keystone Corner to hear Miles Davis or Cecil Taylor, and I never went. And I was like, damn, I just kind of forgot how important this music is to me. So that whole thing of being kind of interested in song again, even if I didn't go and write songs, but just, and that sort of came together, and the art ensemble represented particularly a way, you know, and I say the art ensemble on purpose because I love Anthony Braxton and I love George Lewis and I love so many things of the AACM. But as great as that music is, none of it kind of served me as a path forward the way the art ensemble did. So I think I started writing music that went in, you know, a lot of different directions. And I think that one early example of that is this concert that was actually sort of my first record, at least on another label. I had put out something on a label of my own first, but which was with Butch Morris and William Parker. And it's down at Studio Henry that we were talking about. And it was just live. And I had two little themes. One was kind of a hymn and one was just kind of a theme. And we just started playing. And, you know, William really came out of what he's still doing today. I mean, of course, he played with Cecil for years. But Butch particularly was also kind of interested in improvised music, having less assumptions about what that meant. You know, assumptions that were kind of related to what's, for better or for worse, kind of was started to become referred to as free jazz. And these themes were like just places for us to get to. We didn't start with them. And each piece has just an improvisation that leads to a theme and then goes away again. And also I was starting to use some electronics. I play Farfisa organ on that, and I play amplified piano and process piano. And I think it's something that I've done a lot of since then, which is that I was playing electronics, but I was playing electronics at an acoustic music volume level. And so there was sort of a chamber music sensibility about electronics that's lived with me ever since.
Now, I know we're not going to go chronologically here, but speaking of piano and electronics, I'd love to talk to you about the Snow Ghost sessions. I really enjoy this album.
Oh, good. I'm so glad, because I feel like it's an underappreciated record, you know?
Yeah, it's such a great listen, and I really enjoy the feel of the album. Can you tell me how that project came to be?
Well, it's pretty simple. Jeff Harper and Eric Eagle and I are friends here in Seattle, and we've played a lot of music together, but not trio that much. And sometimes at the Royal Room, we'll do like a tribute to, you know, a pop artist we love or something, you know, a tribute to Mavis Staple or whatever. And you know, those guys will often be involved. And we've played a fair amount of jazz together, not so much publicly, but just because we like to work on playing, you know, standards and bop tunes and stuff. And I got this offer, some free studio time. And I just said to them, listen, you know, I don't have a budget, but if you want to go to Montana for a week and hang out, we'll just do stuff. And I have to say, I've never come to a recording session less prepared. And I mean that in a good way, because I knew that I wanted to do that. I mean, I brought like tons of music, some of which I'd recorded already, some of which had been used in other contexts, but weren't necessarily recorded and weren't meant for bands. Some which were little like snippets of chamber music pieces I'd written, like for string quartet, but sort of piano reductions of, and some of them behaved more like tunes. And I just wanted to go in there for 8 or 10 hours every day and see what happened. So, you know, I said, you know, I'll pay for your gas, I'll pay for, you know, lodging, we'll have food, we'll have drinks, and, you know, but besides that, I don't have much. And the deal was is that at the end, we would play for a small thing that the owner of the studio had brought together. It was actually a bunch of audiophiles who wanted to A-B two different audio formats. I mean, it couldn't have been nerdier, right? It was pretty hilarious. So we set up on the Friday to play for them, and they literally sat in another room and listened to the music, but also A-B'd these two formats. It was pretty hilarious. So we've had 5 days there, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff that didn't get on the record. I mean, because it took me a long time. I went through a lot of stuff. Human just said, let's keep rolling. And so, but yeah, I love that record too. And there's a very, I think I do play some keyboards in a few places, but mostly it's either just straight piano in some cases, or amplified piano and processed piano. And, you know, one of the struggles with amplified piano is that, unlike guitar, electric guitar, you can have just the process sound come out, or a combination of the process sound. You can't control that with piano. It's going to be heard acoustically. But when you record, it's great, because you can send the electronics just to the tape, and then you've got the acoustic piano, and so you can really decide later what you want that relationship to be. Thank you.
We've talked a little bit about the Royal Room, and for those who don't know what it is, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what it is and what your vision was for it, getting it started.
Well, it was basically a really idiotic choice. I mean, starting a club is just the dumbest thing anyone can ever do.
That's the start of a band, maybe.
Yeah. No, I've always said the worst money I ever made was as a sideman, except as a leader, that's even worse. Except as a club owner, that's even worse. I mean, I've just lost money as a club owner. I mean, not that people need to know that, but that's the fact. I approached my friends Steve and Tia, who were the people who started the OK Hotel, which I don't know if you know about, but the OK Hotel is a legendary club in Seattle in the 90s, like one of my favorite clubs ever. Mostly a rock club, but was super open-minded. Zony Mash started by being the house band in the front room on every Tuesday night, and later moved to the larger room to play, you know, real gigs. Bill Frisell and I did a bunch of stuff there. Robin played there a lot. But also Smells Like Teen Spirit literally had its first performance at the OK Hotel. And they were very close with particularly the Soundgarden people. And that's one of the ways I met Matt Cameron, who I still do things with occasionally. And so, but all those guys were playing at the OK Hotel in the early days. By the time the OK Hotel ended, they were all superstars by that point. But in 89, 90, 91... you know, that scene was still small and starting to get big. So I actually met a lot of those people. Haddon Shepherd, who was in Soundgarden. Stone Gossard was someone who was really helpful to myself and a bunch of other people. He was very generous with his studio and all sorts of stuff from Pearl Jam. But anyway, so the OK Hotel basically died in the earthquake in 2001, I believe. And then they went on to form a couple of other places, including Tia started a bar called Lottie's Lounge in Columbia City, which is just south of where I live. And then I got it in my head that there are really no great places in the South End of a certain sort. I mean, I wanted a place that was not just for kids, that would have a good piano that you could sit and listen to music in. And they were more on the bar food side. And Steve plays drums a little bit, but neither of them are professional musicians. But they've been club owners. So I partnered with them. So the three of us are the owners. And we started and we opened in 2011. And it's been open ever since. And so, you know, it's for people who've never been there. Like I said, it's sit down. There's a beautiful Steinway grand piano there. But we have all sorts of music. People kept referring to it as a jazz club. I was like, no. not at all. It is definitely not a jazz club. It is a club that presents, you know, we don't have heavy metal or really loud hip hop because we don't have the PA for it. And there's a lot of glass and wood in the room. I mean, it just sounds terrible in there if it's too loud, but pretty much any other music. We've had a lot of contemporary music. We've had, you know, sort of even traditional classical music in there. A lot of singer-songwriters, a lot of just flat-out rock bands and alt-rock bands and lots of jazz and, you know, a lot of Latin music, you know. Some dance music. So it's cool. And we get, you know, Earshot Jazz will use it, so we get some national acts then, and people do come through that are national acts, but it's only 120 people, and we don't like to charge too much money, and we try to keep it affordable. And so, yeah, I think of it as essentially a community-oriented club. It looks like a jazz club. You go in, it's seated, it's got a certain kind of lighting, and it's got a piano on stage. It's the piano that makes everybody think it's a jazz club. I mean, it's as simple as that, you know?
Yeah. When I was moving to Seattle, people had told me, oh, you're lucky, you can go check out the Royal Room. And another place that they mentioned right away was Cornish College of the Arts, which I know you have a connection to as well. Being adjunct faculty there.
Well, I was adjunct faculty for a little while. I'm not anymore. But really, to be honest, I had a fine experience as adjunct there, but I didn't do that much there. My most profound experience with Cornish was when I moved here, because I met Avon Kang and Brigham Krause and Reggie Watts and Tim Young and Jeff Harper, who I was just texting as you walked in the door, who's stayed local. All those other guys have gone on to, you know, be all over the world, really. And they were all going to Cornish when I arrived here. And there was a great scene at Cornish. I mean, Julian Priester was still there. Jay Clayton was there. Gary Peacock had just left there. So many interesting people were there. And it was a real scene. And I think Cornish is great now. And my friend James, who's a great clarinet player, has been involved with Cornish now and is doing great things there. But it just was a different era. You know, it was late 80s, and there was just, and also what was going on here. Seattle wasn't an expensive place to live for artists. So there was a different vibe here, no question about it.
You moved to Seattle in 88?
I believe we moved the New Year's Day 89, I think, yeah.
Did you at that time have your feet firmly planted in two different coasts?
No. I'd go on the road. I'd go to Europe or I'd go to New York. I'd do things in the East Coast. And, you know, I might play in Seattle two or three times a year. I didn't really know musicians here. I wasn't really looking to meet musicians here. I mean, I wasn't against it. I just wasn't actively doing it. Naked City was really active then. In fact, I almost made the decision to move to Seattle knowing that Naked City was going to be together for at least another year or so, because I knew I had that work plus the other things that were happening for me, which was included a new record deal with Nonesuch and a bunch of other stuff, was all going. So I felt like, okay, I can take the risk to leave New York. I'm not sure that turned out to be true. I think it still had some downsides as well as some obvious upsides. But, I mean, the upsides were that, you know, for my kids, and I really do like it here, and I have a great house. And I also ended up having a killing music scene here in Seattle. But I do think I missed some things that might have happened if I'd stayed in New York. I mean, I always say, in fact, John Gilbreth, who's the guy who runs Earshot Jazz here, and I were talking about this just the other day. I was saying, you know, like, I did this huge orchestra piece called Joe Hill, which was like an opera with Bill Frisell as the soloist and stuff. You know, if I did that at the University of Washington in a big hall, but no one in Europe knew about it. You know, if I'd done it at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, every promoter in Europe would have known about it. And then that's been the downside of living in Seattle, is that kind of sense of what's going on. People always still look to New York and Chicago to see what's happening from all over the world.
I brought a couple CDs with me that I've had for a long time. These are both Naked City albums. And there's a track on here I'd love to ask you about, because I remember when I first heard it, it's called Latin Quarter. I remember how hard it hit me, and I was really into it as a keyboard player. What was it like playing in Naked City and that turn on a dime style? Did you like it?
Oh, sure. I enjoyed it a lot. It was really challenging. And in fact, one of the things for me is that I had never really been like, even though obviously people don't think of Naked City as a rock band, it was a rock keyboard player's role a lot of the time, in the sense that, you know, I would play organ here and then piano and then synthesizer here and then sampler here. So if you're, and, but the funny thing is, instead of doing that because you're trying to recreate the record, we did it live first and then did it on record, you know. But, well, that Latin Quarter tune is a thing too, because, you know, I mean, I'm not a New Orleans pianist. I mean, that's a music that I've loved and admired all my life, and I've dabbled in it, and I dabbled in it on that track. Luckily, it's only 3 minutes long, you know. but you know, it's like, and luckily, it's a key I'm comfortable in. But I really felt almost at the end of Naked City that I didn't have enough time to really, you know, get all those skills together, including the fact that I hadn't played organ really at all. And so I then, you know, one of the reasons I formed Zony Mash was to get better at organ. One of the reasons I formed Pigpen was just to extend the skills that I was learning in Naked City. I mean, some of the original music for Naked City also was sort of in the style of Naked City, and to some extent, you know, took some of Zorn's ideas. But quickly that changed. It really got back to being kind of my music. But it was very keyboard oriented, you know, and so I continued to be able to evolve that stuff because it was a lot, you know. And, you know, everyone else was just, I mean, they're all amazing, but, you know, Joey Barron was going to play the drums in Naked City, and he was going to play the drums on a, you know, when he's playing with a jazz singer. And whereas I was just like, every tune was different. And Zorn had me doing a lot of things with sampler, and I had for all you older keyboard nerds out there, I had an Akai S900, and literally it could hold maybe 6 seconds of sampling, which, you know, your phone can hold 4 hours of sampling, and it was on floppy disks. And we had, as you know, because you're a fan of that music, a lot of these pieces, there was a whole series of pieces that were very short, so they were like a minute long, and sometimes John would call the next tune and I'd have to load the disc, and the loading the disc was almost as long as the tune, you know, and he'd just be looking at me, and I could hear the thing going ka-kung, 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 you know, the hard drive. And then as soon as the little readout said, you know, go, and then of course I had a couple of samples, so I had to make sure that I was on the right sample, like there'd be not many because there wasn't room, but there'd be a list, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it would say the name of the tune, and I'd have to move to 3 and look at him, and then he'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, and then, you know, 45 seconds later I'd be loading another sample. I mean, it was pretty nerve-wracking. I mean, I loved it, but it was pretty nerve-wracking. We'll be right back.
Yeah, you mentioned Zoni Mash. I'd love to ask you, as a keyboardist, playing both piano and organ, when you feel drawn to one or the other, and how they serve your expressivity differently. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Well, you asked me at an interesting time in my life, because I've really pretty much given up playing the organ except for the sort of, you know, like play some chords or play some things like on a song or something. I mean, I love the sound of it so much, but I never, and in recent years, I mean, even though I started really late, I always felt sort of more comfortable on the piano. And in recent years, by recent, I don't mean even that recent, the last 15, even 20 years, I've really worked a lot at the piano. I mean, I practice in some ways more than I ever have. And I feel like there's still things at the piano that I'm not very good at, and I feel there's things I wish I was better at. But at my best, I'm really, you know, proud of my piano playing, and I'm particularly proud of my sound and that I kind of have a unique concept. I still wish that I could rip like a lot of people I admire or even friends, and I'll sort of never be that pianist. But organ, you know, it's funny. I've been listening to some live tapes because I've been releasing some live tapes. And I've been listening to some Zoni Mash stuff when we were playing a lot. And I was like, oh, you know, I'm not so bad after all. I mean, I sound pretty like I have chops. And I feel now, even recently, we've done it every Christmas. And I just, you know, you need to play it all the time. It is such a great instrument, but I think that hard to do both. I mean, there are people, but I think you identify, like my friend Joe Doria in town here. I mean, you know, he's a good piano player, but he is an organ player, you know. I mean, and you think of, I mean, I think one of the few exceptions, I have heard Larry Goldings play piano, and he's a beautiful piano player, but you know, what an incredible organ player. But I feel like organ is, and it's funny, when I got into organ, there were people around me who sort of said, oh, you know, this is really your instrument, you know? And I was always like, oh, thanks. But I never quite felt that way, you know? I mean, honestly, I don't even feel like, I probably feel like the one thing that I'm sort of, the one keyboard that I'm an exceptional voice on is something that I really don't do very often anymore, but used to do a lot of, is as an improvising synth player, you know? And there's not much call for that in the world, you know, and I still get together with, it was a lot more in New York in the 80s, but just to be, you know, I think it's like a completely, that doesn't really sound like anything I've ever heard from anybody else, what I do. And the funny thing is I have to admit that I use a DX7 almost exclusively, nice. But with a bunch of pedals and patches that I created. But I really do go to the piano almost exclusively now.
Well, I really enjoy your piano playing. There's a particular record I'd love to ask you about called Some Places Are Forever Afternoon, based on the poetry of Richard Hugo. You know, when we talk about the instrumentalist, we say they have a way of speaking through their instrument, and I really enjoy the way you speak through the piano on that album.
Well, thank you, yeah. Well, one thing about that album is that it's all my compositions, too, and the truth of the matter is that I did a film score for a Japanese film, silent film years ago, and there's a guy in town who's a great drummer. His name is Byron Vannoy, and he's kind of stopped playing, but I was with my friend Jeff Harper and Greg Sinibaldi, who now lives in New York, and a couple of other people, and we're doing this score. And a lot of it's written out, a lot of other people improvise on it. It's with vibes, two reeds, bass drums, piano. I don't solo a lot. And then there was this kind of a waltz towards the end. It's, you know, sort of got jazz changes and stuff. And we're recording. I'm listening back to my solo. And I'm just like, just really down on myself. And Byron, who's just this natural drummer, just always sounds great. He's like, wow, Wayne, you know, go easy on yourself. He said, do you feel that way as a composer? And I was like, oh, absolutely not. I mean, I realized, and I'd never thought of it before. But I mean, I just feel really confident as a composer in a way that I never feel at any instrument. And I think, you know, it's a different relationship to music. I mean, you're in control in a different way. And that's true even when I bring in a score to something that should make me nervous, like the Seattle Symphony. And I can go and play a stupid gig for 30 people and be way more nervous like, oh God, people are going to find out I can't really play the piano. You know, it's just like feeling like sort of a charlatan, you know, what is that called? Imposter syndrome, you know? And I just don't feel that way as a composer. I kind of feel fairly egotistical. You know, I guess I'm old enough now, I can admit that. And it's taken a while to get there. But, you know, I even listen back to, you know, configurations I put together 35 and 40 years ago, and I'm just really proud of the music, you know. But I still go out in the bandstand and just think, oh, I wish I could play, you know. So, but one thing about that record is, you know, one thing about playing on your own compositions is that you get to choose when you play, you know. I didn't give myself the solo that Ron Miles had to take on the one section where he killed it, and I, you know, might not have.
Yeah, there are so many tracks on this album that are great, but one that I've been listening to over and over is called The Car That Brought You Here Still Runs.
Yeah, sure, which is the longer piece, yeah. I think. Yeah, the suite, yeah.
Yeah, there's this improv moment in the middle that's just, it, you know, it's so beautiful and it just hits you.
Well, if you're talking about what I talk about, there's two parts of that track, which is almost 9 minutes long, that I love. One is, there's a little theme, and then the cellist and I do a duet that's completely improvised. And then later, there's a thing that almost sounds like smooth jazz, chord-wise, where Ron Miles takes one of the most beautiful solos anyone has taken in music in the entire history of music. I mean, it just brings me to tears every time I hear it. Of course, it's even worse now that he's passed, you know, that how it makes me feel. But it is just phenomenal. But the duo that Peggy and I did, when I went to write for the Seattle Symphony, I wanted a section that was kind of open in a certain way that really had a very sort of floating time feel, and I wasn't sure how to get it. I ended up transcribing what I played on the piano and then orchestrated it for orchestra and had Bill improvise very freely in it for the first kind of, there's an opening theme, and then after that, like the first couple of minutes is a transcription of that. And the other thing that's funny is it's very simple. I don't play a lot. And yet it took me like 3 days to transcribe because notating it was almost impossible rhythmically. Obviously, the pitches were easy. But rhythmically, like how to express, because it was very, you know, non-pulse oriented. And I just kept finding different strategies to notate it. And it kept being unsatisfactory. And finally, I got something that at least I could live with. Yeah, that's interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, you wear many different hats: composer, performer, free improviser, band leader. I'm wondering when you feel composition. I guess I don't know quite how to say it. I was listening to your string quartets, which are gorgeous.
Oh, thanks.
What people on the outside might call serious composition or serious music. You know, you wrote a string quartet.
Well, you know, it's interesting you should say serious composition, because that's fine. And, you know, there is, you know, serious music. And speaking of all the things we did in New York with Bobby Previtt, who's an old close cohort of mine, you know, we had one day where we played like, we met someone in a bar at like 10 in the morning for this little film shoot. I don't mean we went there to go drinking. I mean, the scene was in a bar and we were supposed to be playing in the corner. And then we played this, like, you know, reception at NYU for students. You know, we were trying to make a living, right? Anyway, and then we ended up playing at Roulette, and then we ended up playing at 8BC, which was this rock club in New York that was basically across this abandoned lot. We basically played five concerts of five different kinds of very different disparate musics culturally, you know, and we ended up making up this song, like, we played some rock, we played some jazz, we played some serious music too, you know, like a Broadway show. And it just became this dumb joke between the two of us for a few years. And well, first place, to answer your question more directly, I don't even think of it as choosing to be a composer. I years ago, when I was in a job interview, someone asked me, you know, how do you define a composer? I said, well, that's easy. It's someone who tells other people what to do. You know, it's as simple as that. I mean, you get to be the boss. And I'm sure some people will take umbrage with that, but that's essentially what's going on. And you can be a composer in a lot of different ways. So I wanted to put together my own projects pretty much from the moment I started playing. And what's interesting about that is I was almost always, and to this day, playing with people with more traditional music skills than I have, which was great. Like when I put the New York Composers Orchestra together, which was a jazz big band, you know, I was literally leaning over to Art Barron and Ray Anderson and Marty Ehrlich and saying, I know I wrote this, but what bar are we in? You know, because I was standing up there trying to conduct it. And because I'm not a reader, I like to joke that I can write music quicker than I can read music. You know, I'm not a sight reader. I mean, I can read music now, but, you know. But I write music very well, and I don't just mean in terms of the content and the aesthetic. I also mean that I write it technically well. I mean, I've got my, you know, all the nerdy things that make us, you know, when I took my piece of the Seattle Symphony, the conductor had two very small comments about something he wished was notated differently. I mean, you know. Believe me, you could do worse than that. So I have learned to write music in that sort of educated sense, you know, in the Western canon sort of sense very well. And I think of what you were, you know, having trouble describing and said serious music, I think of it in a very simple way. I think of it as music written for conservatory-trained musicians. And this is a really important point to me, because I think that you have to work with the culture you have. Like, there's a lot of, and I may get flack for this, but there's a lot of use of very extended techniques in new music and classical music that basically often just sound bad because the person is not comfortable playing them. And music only sounds good when people are comfortable playing. So, which is why so much extended technique that gets used in improvised music sometimes sounds better, because those are players who've come up with that technique themselves. So it's what they want to do. Which brings me to Butch Morris, who in his conductions often worked with all classical ensembles, usually younger European ensembles. And I think that some of his best conductions are with those groups, because they've spent their whole life learning to play in an ensemble. They're not used to being the ego person in the jazz soloist kind of way, so they don't mind improvising in a way that's oriented towards the total good, if you will. And they have great extended techniques from playing so much 20th century music, but they get to choose which ones to use. So I think a lot of that music really sounds beautiful. But I was putting bands together from the beginning, which is being a composer. Yeah. You know, sometimes I brought in tunes that were ahead and we improvised on it. Sometimes I wrote something out more completely. And then obviously I went to do a lot of music that was fully written. But I still make music where I give people three bars and say, let's do this, you know, with it, or let's don't, or we'll decide together what to do with it. I think the main thing is that, when do I turn to the computer? When do I turn to the piano? When do I turn to, you know, using Logic or using Pro Tools to make the music? When do I turn to electronics to make the music? When do I turn to pencil and paper? And when do I turn to my fellow players to basically help me compose it? And that's really an understanding of what the end result is that you want. And what's the best way to get that? Is the best way to get that to figure out how to write something that makes this happen, or just to use a person who already has that language set and you can count on them?
That's all for our show today. I want to thank Wayne Horvitz for taking the time to talk with us at Relevant Tones, and thank you for your music. Also, a huge thank you to our listeners. It's your support that makes this show possible. We want to hear from you, your thoughts on the episode and the music. If you've been to the Royal Room and you love it, let us know. Drop us a line at relevanttones.com. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. For Relevant Tones, I'm Stephen Anthony Rawson. Thanks again for listening, and be well.